last day, then we can try to deal with anything that might be seen as practical, you know, difficulties or applications of what has been discussed. Something to keep in mind is very important, is that to be able to nicely understand and apply the concept of varnashram, we have to be able to understand and apply the principles that are above it, that it depends upon. In other words, that it is situated on. Just as a house is situated on the foundation, and only according to the foundation can you establish or build your house. In the same way, varnashram can only be established nicely on the foundation that we get from the philosophy of Krishna consciousness and understanding the sadhana, the devotional practices, the devotional understanding of how the process works. Because if we understand how devotional service works, then we can also understand how the varnashram works. Because those of us who are interested in following varnashram are following daiva varnashram. And this daiva varnashram, its purpose is to serve the Lord, is to keep the Lord in the center. So with that understanding, then it works, we see, hand in hand with the devotional process. In fact, everything is connected. As we gave example, is that we have some details of varnashram dharma. We see the husband and wife, the husband is leading, the wife is following the relationship between them. The husband is a little bit senior to the wife. Then we see that the husband and wife are supposed to deal pleasantly with each other. At least in front of the children, they shouldn't be dealing in an unpleasant way. Then one should not be criticizing, you know, other authorities. One should deal nicely with the authorities. It's just me. Nicely with authorities. There should be the proper mood of care shown for the children. You know, the shelter is there, the care is there. Someone will say these are so many rules and regulations, and okay, this is Vedic, this is how they get it done. We in the West have another idea. You know, different cultures, different ideas. So that was practical 5,000 years ago, that we agree, yes. You know, we've heard. But today is a different scenario. So one can think like that, if one only has the intelligence to see details, and one does not have the refined intelligence to see beyond the details. So this kind of understanding that yes, maybe before it applied, now it doesn't, this is for those without discrimination. So the Aryan culture, which is the culture of those who have inquired about the Supreme, who are interested to know about the higher subject matters. So this means, first, to be an Aryan, one has to be able to discriminate between matter and spirit. So human life starts with discrimination. And human beings, they are able to understand and follow the Vedic principles. So therefore we can understand the Western culture, because it does not give rise to this understanding very easily, is not a culture meant for humans. Right? We see it as a very rough culture. Maybe sophisticated, but it is rough. The moods are rough. Krishna describes in the Bhagavad Gita the cult of dhamma. So the Nara dhamma is quite sophisticated. You know, they take the red wine with the meat, the white wine with the fish. They eat the salad, you know, the salad with the smaller fork, the dessert with the smaller spoon. They take the soup with the big round spoon. They have the different shaped, you know, goblets and that for the different kinds of wines and drinks, like this. So it's quite sophisticated. But it is very rough. It is not actually meant for someone who is of a finer quality of character, like that. So the Vedic culture is meant for humans. It is the perfect culture. So now we can, now so that we can say, well, that is an opinion. That is one opinion. But if we just take out the sinful activities and, you know, dovetail, you know, the activities in Krishna's service, fine. But that is if you can dovetail it. If you can dovetail the husband and wife fighting in front of the children in Krishna's service, that's nice. But it may be very difficult to say, to actually practically do. So the talk is cheap. So now, on that level, in other words, we're discussing just on the platform of religion, right? Just on the platform of religion, just on ritual. That one could say it doesn't apply today. But that is because we're not seeing the principles behind it. So to get to these principles, then we have to go through higher, into higher standards. Means the varnashram is the detail of how we apply in our life. But then we see the sadhana, and that's according to our specifically our conditioned nature. Right? The gross conditioned nature. While the sadhana is for the subtler aspects of conditioned nature. So now we have to go to that to see, you know, how, what do these mean? All these rules are there, you know, we don't see them going on today. They don't seem to be practical. So then we go to the next level of sadhana. Then we see that there is the proper element of that shraddha, you get some faith, sadhu sangha, you associate, then bhajana kriya, one surrenders to the spiritual master, takes up the devotional process. Then anartha nivritti, all these things, it continues. So we come, we associate, we have respect for the authorities in that, otherwise we cannot associate, you can't associate with those who you don't have some respect for. So then on this platform we see that this association goes on nicely, faith is being developed by those we associate with, we surrender to higher authorities. Right? If we associate with bad association, we want to surrender to higher authorities. Right? Means we come to the temple, we associate with the devotees there, leading devotees there, then from that association we understand we must surrender to Guru. Right? So now we throw that, go back, looks, now let's look at this process in the varnashram. Is the child, when they grow up, they first understand the mother. So that mother must take care of them, deal with them, and instill faith. Right? If there's no faith, the child will not, first of all, accept that the mother is going to take care. And second, won't accept that what the mother says is of use. Mother's saying, be nice, be good, do this, do that, don't do this, don't do that. So the child has to have faith to do that. So when the faith is there, the child accepts. So that means there must be care, there must be all these different aspects. Then the sadhu sangha takes place. Then the mother can train the child very nicely in all these different aspects of character. Right? And with time, then the child starts to see the father is the authority because the mother is supporting that principle. Right? If we go to the temple and the temple devotees don't support the concept of guru or senior devotees, one will not surrender. But if they support, you naturally move to that step, that stage. So in the same way, then the child then sees the father as the next authority. And that starts now the parampara concept. Right? It began with the mother, then it expands to the father. Right? Then from there, the parents, they deal nicely, don't speak badly about authority and other devotees. Then naturally the child develops faith and associates with those then outside the home. and takes advantage of senior association till they surrender to Guru. Right? So the process becomes very easy. Now that can't work if the mother is senior to the father or equal to the father. There must be that slight little bit of difference. Then we see the whole parampara thing works. And it says, don't become a mother or father unless you can save the child from death. And you only get saved from death by surrendering to Krishna, surrendering to Guru. You don't get saved from death by a nice big house, by big, big trusts, by a Mercedes Benz, by, you know, some, you know, medical aid. None of these. You're saved from death by surrendering to Guru and surrendering to Krishna. So it is the duty. So then we see it works. This aspect works there. Then you go to the next level. Why that? So in the philosophy we see Krishna is the Supreme Lord. We're His servants. And we should serve Him through the process of devotion. Right? We should serve Him through the process of devotion. And you learn that by surrendering to the devotees of the Lord. Right? So then the practical details are in the sadhana. And then we see the practical details in their life. So that same devotion, then with respect, with affection, we're serving the parents. Then with more deep affection and all that, now coming more strongly manifesting the spiritual sides of the spiritual master. Like this, then it gradually develops into pure love for Krishna. So we see that the philosophy, the sadhana, and the the practices of Varnashram are very intimately connected. So now if you understand those three, then you will find it very hard to follow a Western concept of culture and get the same result. Right? In India, the children have to respect the mother and father. They don't respect them. How they're going to respect senior devotees and the guru? If they don't respect senior devotees and the guru, there's no question of respecting Krishna. Krishna says, one who says he's my devotee is not my devotee. But one who is the devotee of my devotee, he is my devotee. So that is the process. So we may say, well, I don't care about all this, it's Krishna and me. Or just my guru and me. But this is called the Kanista. And if it's just Krishna and me, it's even considered to be what's called an ordinary devotee. It means they're devotee, they're accepting the Supreme Lord. Like that. Anyone who accepts that there's a Supreme God is technically a devotee. But they are classified as what's called ordinary devotee. Then, because they may not follow principles properly, they may not understand the philosophy or, you know, something like that. In other words, they don't understand the philosophy, they don't understand the religion, and they don't know how to put them together. Then, if one then surrenders to guru, bona fide guru, then one becomes a sampradayak Vaishnav. So that is what Krishna considers as a real devotee. One who surrenders to the spiritual master. That's where serious devotional service starts. So anyone who is being trained in that from a young age, then they are having the greatest opportunity to come in contact with the proper process and become a very advanced devotee. So from a very early age, they get a head start. But if we just train them as an ordinary devotee, then they may very likely surrender to Guru and Krishna, but they may also not. As we see, we have so many of the second generation who accept Krishna, accept the chanting Hare Krishna and all that is the process, but that can all come later. Now they have more important priorities. You know, the senses are there, the mind is there, you know, so many other things that are more valuable. And we will engage ourselves in these, and then later, when we get a little bit, you know, tired with these things, which we understand the philosophy, you'll get tired, but since we're not tired, we'll have a good time. When we get tired, then we'll start getting serious. So this is because then they're not experienced, they haven't experienced the actual proper culture. So then it makes surrendering to guru, surrendering to authorities very difficult. And generally, if you check, you can check each case. You'll find the relationships in the homes, relationships with their teachers, whatever it may be, was not correct. Same principle. If they're under the teachers, teachers don't accept authority. Teachers are bad-mouthing other teachers, fighting with other teachers. Then the child will not develop that also. It will not go to the next stage. First it was with the family, now with the teachers. It's not being, again, pushed forward. So then it can break down. Like this. So the whole culture is a very nice package. It's all connected. You can't accept one and not the other. Right? You have to take it all together. Then it works very nice. Like we can say, well, I like the drink, I don't like the glass. You know, so just give me the drink. Where you'll put the drink? You know, pour it on your head or what? You know, it comes together. The drink is the essence, but it comes in a glass. Like that. So like that, the philosophy of Krishna consciousness, the devotional process of sadhana bhakti, that's the substance. But you have to put it somewhere. So it comes in the glass of Varnashram Dharma. Yeah. Then you can take it. You can accept it very easily. Like that. So one may say, the glass, what's the use of the glass? But the point is it's part. So we can see when all three are understood, then the conditioned soul is benefited. Just like you understand the philosophy is devotion to Krishna, we see also devotion to the other devotees, proper devotion and care with the parents. And then the parents, because Krishna cares for the devotees, then amongst the devotees, they have to care for the other devotees. Parents must care for the children. So all these, they're all interconnected. So one can see that complete picture. It makes the thing very, very easy. Because this is what we're actually looking at. The reality is life is temporary. We're being offered this one lifetime. You give it to Krishna. You go back to Godhead. So for one lifetime, we have to make a little adjustments this way and that way. What is the problem? Right? And that's not a big problem. Because we're just being asked. Demigods are sitting around for, you know, hundreds of millions of years, and we're being told in just a few, 50, 60 years, you know, like that, go back to Godhead. Like that. So we must try to understand when we're reading Bhagavatam, when we're reading the scriptures, we can see all these aspects there, the philosophy, the practical sadhana, and the culture that's there. Right? And we can see it, and that is why for us, the philosophy, the transcendental philosophy is presented, we discussed this yesterday, through the Puranas, so that we are able to see practically how people did it. Right? And that's just to surrender to the Lord. Then Lord Chaitanya, then to show specifically how to surrender to Krishna in the mood of the residents of Vrindavan, then he came and performed his pastimes, which we have in Chaitanya Charitamrita. So we see there then so many practical things, how they sit down, take prasad, you know, what they do if someone is born, what to do if someone's died, all the different aspects that are going on in the leelas there of the Lord. How the grihasthas would behave, how the brahmacharis, the sannyasis, vanaprastas, like we see, Advaitacharya is sitting next to Nityananda Prabhu, and he's saying, well, I'm a grihastha, Advaitacharya is saying, and it appears I'm breaking the proper rules of the grihastha that I'm sitting and associating with known people who you know who they are, what they'll do. In other words, they've kind of been, you know, how you say, observed a bit. But now I'm sitting next to this avadhut who may do anything at any time, and I don't know, you know, what may happen and what will be the results. So, you know, my stand in the society may be reduced by this lack of discrimination on my part. Like this, they're joking. But these different aspects are there. Amongst the devotees, maybe a laughing, joking, and playing. But when you're dealing with the material world, then this is the standard. So the whole point here is the loving exchange between the devotees. How they're taking prasad, the exchange, taking a shot is not a dry affair. If you look in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, it's not some dry, austere activity, but it's something where devotees sit down and discuss nicely light topics or some light philosophy, and they enjoy the atmosphere because they're associating with Krishna. So Krishna and his devotees are always together. So you don't see Krishna alone in a very dry atmosphere. It's Krishna with his devotees in a pleasant atmosphere. No maya, just a pleasant atmosphere. So when we're taking prasad, there's Krishna there, and the devotees are with Krishna, and they're taking prasad. So we see this. So these are things we can learn, how we can take prasad. Because many places I go, it's like you come in, eat as quickly as possible, leave, because eating is maya and all that. Or if they do sit and all that, then generally there has to be some, you know, useless topic to discuss, and that keeps everybody there, you know, talking about some movie or, you know, this guy did this and that guy did that, or, you know, something else, not necessarily Krishna conscious. The atmosphere is then in that case, or issues, and it's a very heavy atmosphere, or it's complete prajalpa, or it's, you know, the dry austere, you know, come eat and run because it's all maya. But the whole point is you can create a pleasant atmosphere by taking prasad with devotees. And so the Chaitanya Charitamrita shows that. If you read and are sensitive, you can catch the mood, the atmosphere that Lord Chaitanya's devotees are presenting. And we can try to imply that in our life. Right? So in so many ways, we see dealings going on. Right? Advaitacharya dealing with his wife. You know, Sachimata, how she deals with the with Nimai. You know, like he's going and sitting on a pile of clay pots and dirty clay pots. Now, okay, now if they were just some other local village kids, mother would just come in there and yell and say, "Get out of there!" like that, and that's all. But here, they're from, you know, high class Brahmin family, so to become contaminated is very bad. Like that. You have to go take bath, change all your clothes, everything. Like that. They're very strict on these principles of cleanliness. And we see, Prabhupada said cleanliness. Women should be trained in cleanliness. Here, it's Mother Jashoda's trying to teach her son how to come to the Brahminical standard of cleanliness. Right? Doesn't mean how to sweep the room. That's one part of it. But how to be pure. And she doesn't come there and just yell, "Get out of there." She comes and said, "Why you're there? You know, don't you know that's dirty?" And then Nimai wants to have some fun, so then he starts saying, "Well, it's all one, whether I'm here or whether I'm in a clean place, what does it matter?" So then Sachimata has to explain it to him. In other words, if you want to raise a child nicely, there's no such thing as only yes and only no. There has to be a reason behind it. Why should the child do this? Or why should the child not do that? In an emergency situation, yes, then you just have to say, "Don't do that," or "Do this." But when there's time, you must explain. If you don't, this is not such a good parent. Because the perfection of parenthood is Mother Jashoda. So she has come as Sachimata. So she is showing how to deal there. So we can learn so many things. The difference is she's an illusion that this is not God, right? And we should also be very careful to not think our child is God, but to understand that our duty is to make them into a devotee of the Lord, right? So we have to deal. Mother Jashoda was thinking her child is such a naughty child. She didn't think, "Oh yes, he's dropped from the heavenly planets, he's so special." And that people would come to her and say, "Your child's a nonsense doing that." She'd immediately go and chastise him. She wouldn't say, "You don't know my child's so nice, get out of here." Like that. But I've seen that. Modern parents, if someone comes and complains your child is doing something wrong, they say, "You don't understand. My child's perfect." And then when something happens to the child outside, other people around, there's no community feeling. You know, nobody cares. Why didn't anyone take care of the child? Well, we tried to take care, but you told us to mind our own business. So the whole Western culture itself, by nature, must destroy interaction between devotees. The Western culture cannot establish community feeling. Right? The pure Western culture cannot. You only have a community when there's generally some religion involved, right? You know, you have the Amish, the Mormons, the Jews, or you go to Ireland, you have the Protestants, the Catholics, like this. Based on some religious thing, they'll get together. Very seriously, closely. So now, and they're getting some result. And that's from using just basic principles of religion. So the Vedic literature gives very nice, clear definition of very refined culture. Very refined culture. So why we won't get a better result of bringing the community together if we follow the Vedic standard? Right. So these things have to be thought about. Then it becomes very easy. Example is there. Sufficient philosophy is there. Prabhupada's talked greatly on the subject. But we have to take it all and put it all together. We can't just take one and on its own or another on its own. They're all connected. Yes, Mati.
In the home.
Yeah. Something on that. Oh, the Mataji's question is that we find ourselves in some situations in the Western countries. Sometimes there isn't a school, or you can't establish a school, or there's no facilities. So then, how can the parents deal with that? She gave examples. Some of the mothers may find themselves, they go to school, educate themselves, and then they're able to home train, homeschool the children, this and that. So basically, that kind of activity. Now, a lot of these things, you have to see it. It's very much on the local situation. What facilities are there? How much direction or support is being given by the leaders of the yatra? So that has to be considered. But whatever one needs to do in the practical situation, one should try to get it done. But understand these principles. Means if you do have to train them in the house yourself, and that, but these principles still apply, that you have to somehow or another train them to be able to accept authority outside the house. First, they have to be able to accept it inside the house, and that's by proper example and by care. If there's shelter, there's naturally surrender, right? These go hand in hand. If there's shelter, there's surrender. If the managers are extending shelter to the temple devotees and the devotees of the community, naturally there's surrender and cooperation. The parents to the child, the father, the husband to the wife, the guru to the disciples, because Krishna is doing that for us. So he's setting the good example. Right? So now it's our business to follow that example, and it works very, very nicely. So you can do that, but the time to do that is before. This is also a practical thing, is when we discussed the whole thing about marriage, organizing the marriage? Huh? You sure? We didn't discuss about the previous, marriages were arranged? And then now... So that may have some aspect of it. See, as previously marriages were arranged by the family members. So there's some principles behind this. One, it is a very delicate, sensitive mood that is there when you bring, a young boy and young girl together. It's very subtle, very gentle. And shyness becomes a very predominant aspect of it. So now if you want to arrange a marriage, then that means that there's some very specific elements that have to be understood. Then it works nicely. So one has to see that the nature of the boy and girl are very similar. You have to see that the culture, their values, their goals, the methods on how they're going to get those goals are as similar as possible, right? You'll never get 101% because every living entity is unique. But the modes of nature are kind of limited, though it's quite a broad spectrum. But we try to get as close as possible. So previously, the family members know their child and their family traditions and customs very nicely. And because of their very nice dealings with the children naturally imbibe their qualities, their values, their methods. So the two families come together, and the adults from the families, they discuss to find out that the qualities are good enough. Right? And if they're not, then they leave it. They look for another match. So between the discussions, between looking at astrological charts, between actual observance of the girls and the boys, then they will decide this is a good match. Only once that's done, then they start, okay, then the boy and girl may meet and just see that they're also satisfied. And then there's the marriage. And some of them, if it's very, very good, very, very, aristocratic families, you know, very pure lines, the boy and girl don't even have to meet. And it works because everybody knows each other so well that they can create the match. And the mood of duty and all these, you know, so many qualities. So now, these things have to be, if you want to establish a marriage, these things have to be worked out. There's no ifs, ands, or buts. You have to work these things out. So the old system was somebody did it for you, which makes life easy. Otherwise, you have to do it yourself. Right? That means, you know, boy meets girl, and then he has to sit down and ask, they have to ask questions to each other like, are you thinking of being full-time devotees, or you kind of want to live in the congregation and do as much, or you'd kind of like to stay out on the outer edge and just kind of be involved now and again. Or each one has to ask the other, were you planning on having children or not? And then if so, how many children? And then if there is children, then what was the plan for education? You know, were they going to go to a gurukul? Were we going to homeschool and we're going to send them to Harvard? You know, what are we going to do with the kids? Then financially, were we thinking to live in a big, you know, four-bedroom, you know, house with, you know, two Mercedes-Benz and that? Or were we just going to live simply in, you know, whatever the temple can provide us? You know, we don't care. We just want to do service there. You know, these things. Now, is it easy? I mean, of course, there's only a question for those who have been through the ravages of first generation. But it's not easy. It's no question, because when you put boy and girl together, then as we mentioned before, in the spiritual world, due to actual love, attachment for Krishna, then the rasa manifests properly. One is trained and knows, one has the body, everything. So the ecstatic symptoms of the body are actually transcendental. But in the material world, we don't have that. Material world, there's only attachment for matter. Right? So we're having to deal with another soul. And we don't really have a body that can manifest these spiritual symptoms, not in its unpurified state. So therefore, the material nature arranges things such as, you know, hormones and adrenaline and all kinds of other interesting effects. And then when those are there, then you think, yes, this is affection, this is love and all that. It's just a bunch of hormones. So when all those things are moving nicely in the body and all that, there's this euphoria of everything is perfect. In other words, the ananda brahma, the illusion of ananda that the living entity gets, becomes manifest. And the Vaikuntha brahma, it will always be there. So the boy and girl think, no, they're special, everything's perfect, it'll always be nice. And they never bother with these questions. Then the auspicious day comes, they're married, and then sometime after the marriage day, and about 6 months, somehow or another, all the hormones stop to function, And then the boy's looking at the girl and going, who did I marry? And the girl's looking at the boy and, who is this guy? And then they start working out, well, you know, I thought you were like this, you know, you were a really good devotee in that, and I wanted to do this kind of service, and well, I thought you were, you know, going to take care, and we were going to set up a nice house, and this and that, and this one wants kids, and that one doesn't want kids, and does it sound familiar? So they're working it out afterwards. And then there's a problem. Right? Yeah, it's a big problem. Sounds like you're speaking from experience here.
Many lifetimes.
Many lifetimes, yes. So, in other words, these things have to be worked out beforehand. So in the same way, applying this to this question is how you're going to educate the child should be planned before you even have the child. I see many devotees, they just have the child, and then somehow or another, when they're about 3 years old, they start to talk, then they start thinking, well, I got to get this thing educated. And then I see them coming around, sniffing around the Gurukul, and, you know, what's happening, what's going on here, and give a little donation, and, you know, maybe we could get involved, and like this and that, you know. And then the closer it's coming, then they're more interested, and like that. So the point is this is to be worked out before. I mean, in we find in India that many times, even India and old school, like in England and that, even in these kind of cult aspects, is that even before the child is born, they've already booked a seat in a very good school. You know, they book two seats, one in the boys' school, one in the girls'. And then they say, we'll confirm it after birth. You know, so it's okay. You know, they have that facility. You know? And then like that. So already before, they've already decided where they're going to go, what schools, what kind of things like this, what is the lifestyle. Everything's been worked out. So since we're coming from so many kinds of mixed backgrounds, we're coming from so many different things, we have to see that the values, all these are similar. Otherwise, we have problem. Because it's not, the husband and his wife are not breaking up because they have a difference in the concept of philosophy. You know, that Krishna is God and the other one says, no, Kali is God. Like that. Generally, you don't find things like that. You know, one says chanting Hare Krishna is the Yuga Dharma and the other one says, no, Yajna or meditation. Generally, you're finding it's just little day-to-day things that just drive you nuts. Either on the platform of sadhana or on the platform of the varnashram activities. So one has to see that these are worked out ahead of time. Then a lot of problems with the children are already worked out. You know? And if there's similar agreement on that, consensus on these things, then one will find that the marriage itself goes nicely because you know what to expect. Because that's the idea. You expect some steadiness, some regularity. You know, no great surprises in the whole marriage thing. Because it's supposed to be a fairly intimate association, and you feel that you shouldn't be, you know, open to too much of a... You can tolerate insanity outside the house. That's the meaning. But when you come to the house, you expect that this is, you know, where it's supposed to be peaceful. Right? So these things need to be understood. So either work them out before or work them out now. But these things help a lot. Does that make some sense? So therefore, if you need to do that, means then if it's decided you're going to homeschool the children, then better before the child is born, you're already working towards that. Because it's not that the mother becomes qualified overnight to teach the child. You have to do some research, you have to do something, you know, contact other devotees who are doing these things. Somehow or another, make some arrangements, you know. And it shouldn't be, because if you do it once a child is born, then unless it can be done in such a way it doesn't disturb raising the child, then the mother may have to spend time at school when she should be with the kid. Then the kid doesn't get trained properly, so then when she goes to train him, she's training a madman, you know. Well, if she's trained before, then puts in the time to the kid, then when it comes time for education, then she has a very nice child to train. Like that. So the whole concept of human life is planning, regulation. Right? That's the meaning. Sadhana means regulation. Varnashram means regulation. Like that. That's the meaning. Then everything works nicely.
With the child.
Oh, I see. A question is, and that is just how to see that the aspect of authority is there. First of all, it's in the house. It's very nicely the child sees the mother, then the father. So in the house, he knows father is the boss, like that. That's how the child sees it. We all understand the actuality is the mother's the boss, but at least to the child, he should see it that the father's the boss, you know, because that sets up the parampara. But in that, then there must be the things where you understand, the child sees outside. The child sees the dealings of the parents with guru, with the senior devotees, you know, as much as possible. If they can't go out, invite people, devotees, to the house. Try to set up some association, you know, like-minded other devotees, senior devotees. Spend as much time as you can at temple programs. Point out, you know, the child's just standing there. Some senior devotee goes by. They don't pay, you know, that they should pay attention. They should pay attention in class because they have to hear. So these are all the different fundamental principles of religion that very much the mother is to teach, and that is backed up by the father. You know, especially at the younger age. When it comes into the teenagers, then you'll find the father has to be the main input, like that. Just somehow or other the nature. You know, like that. So then, that aspect should be there. You have to know that transference from the house to authority must be there. So you must be training in that in whatever way facility you have, encouraging them in the aspect of surrendering to guru. Train them what that means, what is guru, what is disciple, what is dealing with senior devotees, dealing with equals, dealing with those junior to them. It's also important if there's more than one child, the older ones have to learn how to deal properly and be gentle with the younger ones. The younger ones have to be able to respect. Like you see in the Indian families, you have the concept, anyone older, but especially the oldest. You know, if it's a brother, it's Dada. If it's a sister, it's Didi. And they're respected like the parents, the oldest. They're like representatives. Because when the father goes, mother goes, they're the ones that are going to be the senior in the family. So, therefore, I've seen it. I've seen kids, there's a four-year-old kid and a six-year-old kid. And the four-year-old, he has a problem, he'll go to the six-year-old brother, you know, Dada, hey, I have this problem, this, that. And the six-year-old will help him work it out. Even though the other one's, there's only 2 years difference. Because that mood is there. When that mood of surrender is there, the natural thing for a human being is shelter. Right? That's why we see in the Vedic culture, if an enemy surrenders, the Kshatriya cannot kill them. Because when they surrender, there must be protection. Right? It's only in the modern sense, when you're not dealing with humans, someone surrenders but they shoot him anyway. Right? So this may be what we grow up with, and this may be what the kids watch on television, but this is not the reality. So this whole concept, so if the older children can take care of the younger, that then supports them in also. So in other words, one has to learn all three. How to deal with superiors, how to deal with equals, how to deal with juniors. So that's the parents themselves, how to deal with their children as juniors, how to deal with their equals or friends, and how to deal with those senior to them. The children, with the parents and other devotees, then with equals, either friends or if they have brothers, sisters, same ages, and then those who are junior to them, younger than them, how to take care. And then expand that, not only just in their own family, but if friends come, they have kids, the older kids shouldn't bother the younger ones, the younger ones shouldn't bother the older ones, all these different aspects. You seem to be doubtful that it's possible. But this is the reality of Varnashram. When we talk about Varnashram, these are the realities. This is what's breaking it up. Actually, the Varna aspect, much of it's even going on. Those who are business people are doing business. Businessmen, I can guarantee you, there's no businessman in our movement who wants to do business and who's sitting around and saying, no one's given me any opportunity, no one's given me any funds, how am I supposed to set myself up? It's the duty of the authorities. You give a businessman $100, you come back tomorrow, they'll have $150. It's just the way it goes. You talk to any big businessman and ask them how they start out. I met one man on the plane. I was flying to all places to Kyrgyzstan, on Kyrgyzstan Air. And there was this funny guy in this long coat and this funny felt hat, and I thought he looked, you know, a very strange looking person. Getting on the plane, I find out that he's one of the board members of the Bombay Temple. It means that there's life members who help organize, big festivals and all that. And so then, you know, watching, you see he's a very gentle character and all that. And as an Indian, he's wearing the hat and coat because he's got to interface with, you know, all kinds of Western businessmen. And then I find out that he's got, you know, companies and he's got branches and manufacturing units in like 40 countries around the world. You know, he's very, very wealthy man, you know, exceedingly. And he was telling me he started out with 10,000 rupees and started something. And now he's got, you know, his companies, you know, in 40 countries of the world. So this is a businessman. So one doesn't have to worry about that. Right? And then the whole point is that's practically going on. Those who are good managers are managing, or they see it's not worth managing, and they're not managing. But they're not in the bewilderment. They know what should be done, but maybe in this situation it can't be done. Right? Those who have brahminical tendencies, you're doing their puja, they're doing their cooking, this and that. Unless they have more desire, or the temple absolutely doesn't support anyone with that kind of nature, then they may have some problems. So basically it means the main lamentation will be coming from those who are just, they don't have those three qualities. They're not into business, they're not into management, they're not into, a occupation of you know, puja, cooking, or full-time preaching, or some ass teaching, something like that. So that is where the problem comes. And that can only be sorted out when there is shelter. When there's proper shelter, the management works very nicely, and can give the shelter and facilities so that those devotees can situate themselves nicely. So there must always be this aspect of shelter and surrender, like that. Is it connected or is it different? Because otherwise somebody else, okay. Go ahead. Oh, I see. Let's say.
Because in Vedic culture, it was always in the Vyasas, they had the same guru, and there was the man who had two. And in our times, we see the different gurus. And there were young people, they were questioning us. And they were planning marriages. And they were questioning if it is important to have the same guru or maybe it makes any difference.
I see. Okay. The question is on just related to marriage, is it important that the husband and wife have the same guru? So that's not necessarily, because the point is everyone is following Srila Prabhupada's instructions. A bona fide guru means one who trains you in the philosophy and methods, teachings of Srila Prabhupada. So there doesn't necessarily have to be. Though we see some of the gurus prefer that husband and wife are both of the same. And how do you say? But generally that's not important. But what one has to be very careful of In other words, if the mentality is more leaning towards at least practicing trying to become a madhyam, one will find no real problem. Because generally you've surrendered to guru, you have guru, and then, you know, you're trying to work, there'll be a mood there and some activities, but one has to be discussed. Then you can see from that, before marriage, to discuss and work out that the moods are similar. But otherwise, the main important thing to avoid is the kanista mentality of using the instruction of your guru against the other partner. You know, you want this, so therefore, instead of you avoid the husband and go to the guru, or the husband wants this, he can't get his wife to agree, so he goes to his guru. Or like this, it turns into a whole political mess. Whole point is guru is not there for, you know, political stability. And guru is not there to take care of day-to-day nitty-gritties in the house. Unless they have, you know, that experience or that nature that they don't mind doing it. But especially if they're sannyasis, it's recommended to avoid taking these things to them. If they happen to be a grihastha, they may be, or vanaprastha, they may be able to give very nicely. Or if they were grihasthas before and they don't mind, they may hear to some degree. But better to approach the senior devotees and take their advice. Otherwise, how do you develop a community? If it's just you and your guru, that's not a community. Community means there's senior persons in the area that you have some respect for, you have something for. And in this way, you try to gain something, you know, and take their instructions. But we have to be willing to follow those instructions. Then we'll see that then husband can work very nicely together. It doesn't matter. I've seen families where not only the husband and wife have different gurus, each child has a different guru. So there was the parents and three kids, and there were five gurus. Like that. But everything worked together nicely. Because each one respected the other's guru. And if the one guru came to the house or was giving lecture, everybody wanted to go. You know, everyone wanted to take part. And when it was another guru or Vyas Puja, they all would take part. Because they were trained, they were understanding that devotees are special, they want to take part. They want to take advantage of that senior association. You know? Not only that, because they had affection for each other, naturally then who you have affection for, their guru is also part of that picture. Right? You know, so the mother's guru is Vyas Pujas today, so everyone wants to go, or the fathers, or your sisters, or your brothers, or like that. Okay? Yes? There's some question back there? Question is about, you have the parents, you have their children are slightly grown, and then they have friends, they may be strict in their house, but then outside in other houses, we find that, you know, they're watching television, eating karmi food, and, you know, playing so much with karmi this and that, and dealings, and so that's also very much part of, I mean, we'll look at two things. One is the avoidance, and then something how to deal. The main thing is education. Is the child has to know what are the reasons for doing or not doing something. It means why they shouldn't do it, and what is the alternatives why that's good. So it's much more easy to train the children in these things before they come in contact with them. So when they're young, these, that, you can train them with these things. Then the principles of them may go in. You don't necessarily have to tell them about television or something, but they understand the principles of things that deal with Krishna are good, things that are not good, and try to arrange that they have, you know, activities and things that are in line with Krishna consciousness. Try to keep friends who have a similar, just like in the marriage, husband and wife should be of similar nature. Then you also then try to make friendship with other devotees who have a similar nature, similar values. Try to situate yourself in a community that has similar values. Like this. That makes things from the beginning very easy. And then, as I mentioned, there's no just yes or no. There has to be a full explanation why. And that explanation may have to be repeated many, many times. Because children forget very easily, especially something that they are not overly interested in. You know, you always find, well, why did you do that? Oh, I forgot. You know, well, you just told them 5 minutes before. So that means they didn't understand. So again, it has to be explained. Maybe you have to try different angles, different ways, give different examples, and have that tolerance to just go on explaining until they understand. Right? That is an important aspect. Then if they're already older, that same thing should be done, and explain to them what are the difficulties with it. And try to make some adjustments. But one should also be, how do you say, broad-minded understanding, because especially if they're in the teen years, if they're gentle, then the nature is they'll want to do something because they don't want to displease you. If they're not gentle, then they may just do something because they know it displeases you. So one has to see that in the dealing, that one is very careful that one doesn't set up, one may come to the neutral point, but one shouldn't go to the inimical. Because it's very much part of the rasa of teenagers, especially the modern teenagers, that if they know something bothers somebody, they can get some taste out of it. You know? It disturbs someone, so then they can get something out of it. If it doesn't disturb you, they don't care. You know, they'll do something else. So therefore, if you go to a neutral standpoint, you know, I won't do it. I know it's bad. You know, I know what's going on. I've told you. You understand. At least you say you understand. No, you do what you want. You know, like that. And result will be yours. Maybe you don't figure it out today. You'll figure it out. You know, you're a smart kid. And that'll put something in their head because you didn't react badly and this and that, and they can't take that as something to do all kinds of things, and yeah, I did that, my mother really got on my case and all that, and then they'll all sit around and laugh. You know, they'll think. Main thing with teenagers, you have to make them think. That's the main element. When they're young, they have to hear. It means below puberty, the main element is that they're hearing, shravanam. You have to make them think to some degree, but their thinking is going to be not very deep. So thinking process has to be stimulated from that time, as early as you can create it. You know, bring it out. Not create it, but bring it out. Create the situation for it to come out. From, you know, 12, 13, even from 11, you can stay from 11, but it seriously starts at 13 through 16, 17, then even sometimes up to 18, then making them think about what is going on, the situation, the results that they get in a clever way, because teenagers like things that are clever. You know, it can be gentle clever, it can have an edge to it clever. You just have, depends on the kid. You have to be able to adjust according to the kid. Then that aspect has to be brought out. And then from 16 and above, then the trying to bring out the aspect of realization and values. You have to be able to bring it to that. So if the first two stages work nicely, generally at that stage it will come very naturally. So you have to see the fruit of bearing children is that when they're 16, they've decided to be devotees. That's when the benefits of all the work before comes to fruition. Because then they're adults, they're on their own. Like that. Before that, then very much they'll follow just how they're being trained and the association they get with the parents. But at that age, then it's basically, it's their decisions. So that must, they must, that must be respected. Though at the same time, is that support. So if they know that maybe they're going a little wild, but, you know, the house is still there. We won't, the mother and father, we don't change our values. We're going to go on the way we are. You want to change yours, that's your life, you know. You want to rot your brain with the television all day, that's your problem, you know. But we're not doing it. And then with some time, the kid will get sick of it. And because the parents didn't change their values, make any compromise, then the kids will come back. It's just a matter of time. But it's important that parents don't change their, they don't compromise. At the same time, they don't become nasty. You know? And one has to, how you see? Now, if the children are more submissive, even though they have, then one can be stronger and just, you know, enforce the issue. But if they're more wild, then it's like you just have to give more rope. You know? You set the boundaries and tell them they don't go outside that. Yes?
Many people have a different idea of what it means to be chaste. Like, you know, some people think that mothers should be just humble and submissive. I've seen, like, many Indian Matajis not very, you know, kind of very extra heavy sometimes in public. So I'm just wondering, what does it actually mean for a mother to be chaste?
Chaste, okay. The question is what is the actual meaning of chastity, or chaste? It's actually a culture. You know, I mean, the essential principle is that they, if they want to be married, they focus their attention on one person and leave it there. And for the rest of their life, that's where it stays. You know, even after the person's died, it remains there. That's the essential principle. But with that goes then qualities. Generally, you'll find the gentleness and, you know, these aspects of, you know, submission and all these things go along. They're like ornaments on that main aspect. See, the principle is there, is why that is there. Because of the, see, it's like, as we mentioned before, the man, he has, in his workings of his brain, he can be analytical and just be fixed in one place. Or if he becomes emotional, then it goes all over the place. But in the normal situation, they can be fixed by nature. So it's very easy for them to just fix their consciousness just on the Guru, on the Lord. So now, for the girl, because of the nature of the emotional and the analytical happening at once, sometimes that can create a lot of bewilderment. Because then the mind can sometimes think this, that, so many things, and the mind can bring up a amazing collage of insanity, you know. So then the whole idea is then, because of that, the nature of attachment that is there in emotion, it's very easy to convince the mind to become attached, okay, to the husband. It's very natural because the bodily attachments, the emotional attachments, all that, so the mind can fix. So this way it gives the wife two options. See, the husband has one option to go back to Godhead. He has to think of Guru and Krishna, and that's it. If he thinks of his wife, then, you know, he'll be sitting in the, what do you call it? Next life, he'll be sitting in the Varnashram, you know, discussions asking your question. Right? Like that. But now, for the wife, she has now two options. She can think of the Lord and of the Guru, or she can also think of the husband. Like that. And in any of those, either of those cases, she'll get a good result. Right? Because she thinks of Guru Krishna, she'll go back to Godhead. If the husband was a pure devotee, she thinks of him, she'll go back to Godhead. Even if he wasn't a pure devotee, then she'll take a good birth and be able to be fixed. But for the husband, he's only got that one choice. So by nature, it gives. So therefore, the chastity aspect is pointed out so strong for the women. And brahmacharya for the men. Because then, in brahmacharya, the mind will stay on the analytical side. Then it gives a stronger... You understand? Like that. So you also have to see is that in India, you have great, vast differences in strata of culture. Like that. So you'll see that the woman may be very rough and nasty and all that, but generally that will be someone from a not so well-trained background. You know, like that. Some simple villagers who aren't cultured. You know, some you know, whatever it is, new age, got their own philosophy, middle class, or nouveau riche, sometimes you'll see that. Then you get these kind of things. But otherwise, if the family has some tradition, you'll generally see the women are of exceptional character, like that, in India, like that. You just have to know what to look for and be able to tell the stratas, like that. But it's a lot of difference in that way. So when we're talking Bhagavatam, we're talking devotees. So devotees are already on the topmost platform of culture. So we're expected to follow that dealings. But in any case, you'll see even those village women who may be very rough and ready, but their attachment to the husband, the chastity of the husband, is very strong. Like that. Though the ornaments of the chastity are not there. Like that. Maybe in the house, but you know, you get in a fight and stuff like that. They can say some pretty wild stuff. Like that. Is that?
I just wanted to ask, so in the eye of the public, how does like a high class woman appear?
Generally, very shy, very gentle, and tries to stay out of the limelight. You'll generally see that's a major qualities like that. Take care of the kids, see that the kids don't make any problem. If the husband knows what he's doing, then just follow along with that. Husband doesn't know, like the wife has been the one that's been going to the temple all the time, and the husband doesn't, then she'll guide and see that he knows what he's doing. Like that. That would be generally. It's a mood. It's like, what you do is you, like when you read in the Bhagavatam and see how these, you know, great women devotees, how they behave, try to see what is their mood there, what is the attitude, like that. And that works very, very nicely. So amongst women, then one can be a little bit more free in that. But if the public eye is there, then one should be very, very careful, especially how one dresses, acts, stands, moves, like that. It's natural, like that. I even remember seeing one lady in the Ganga. They went down for a bath, and the small kid, because Indian kids generally don't really know how to swim. From Bangladesh, they're good swimmers, but for some of this side, they don't know when they're young. So the kid somehow or other went out a little far, and the kid started to drown. And the mother totally freaked out. I mean, just like basically almost went like, you know, emotionally and, you know, clinically mad. Somehow or another, somebody else came and caught the kid, but it took her a while to kind of like calm down. And as we see, like in the villages, many of them, you know, either due to their culture, what family they're from, means like if they're from Brahmin families, or due to the weather, or due to, you know, just economic standing, then we see that it's not uncommon that the women don't wear cholis, you know? So they just wear the sari. So the Bengali sari, the South Indian sari, are basically designed for that. They're actually Brahminical dresses. While what we normally wear in that is a more general kind of dress. It's meant for wearing with cholis. So they have a dress that doesn't. So even though she was rolling on the ground in that and completely mad. But she was still, because it had been ingrained in her since she was so young, she was still sensitive to see that if she rolled in the wrong way, that she would just pull her sari to keep her chest covered, even though she was completely nuts, like that. So it's just, it's a matter of, it's a mood, it's a matter of training and a sensitivity. I mean, I've seen myself is that ladies will be walking and they're walking somewhere else. They don't know you're there or anything like that, but then suddenly they'll just pull on their cloth, pull this side, because then they can just catch the mood that there's others in the area, and then immediately they just notice how they are fitting, how they are dealing, and then they are able to see if they're dressed properly, everything like that. So that sensitivity is also part of it. It's very standard. No? Is there anything else? No, here. You. Is there anything else? Huh? Does that make some sense? So chastity is more the mood. The externals are there, but it's more a mood. Just like if something very embarrassing happens or something like that, natural thing is you kind of want to hide, cover up, right? So if the mood of shyness is there, naturally one likes to keep the head covered, this, that, you know? Like you go to Rajasthan, you know, which is more, you know, a closest reflection of the Vrindavan culture and all that. They're more worried about covering their head than the rest of their body, like that. I've seen over there, like this side they don't do. Generally women don't do really heavy labor on this side. Somehow or another they'll make some other arrangement, you know. But if you go to like North India, Rajasthan, that side, South, even South India, like these construction sites, you know, carrying mud, cement, bricks on the head, the women are doing that. And the men will do heavier work than that. And you can go to any of those places and they're carrying all this stuff and that. They're wearing saris and their head is covered. And they're working very hard, working on road construction, all that. They just know how to wear their cloth, you know. And that they'll always follow. So it's just part of the mood, you know. They're out there working with the men, this and that, but it's very clear who their husband is and all these things. So when the mood is there, then the natural external form manifests, you know? Does that make any sense? Like that. So that's the whole principle. Especially when they're young, when the girls are protected, these qualities naturally flourish like that. If they're not protected, then they become hard. Like that. You know? But it doesn't matter. I'm just saying that makes it easy. Because it's the nature, a girl at any age, if she finds protection, these qualities will naturally come up. Like that. It doesn't matter what she's been through, because these are the natural qualities. You know, it's just like a fish. It doesn't matter how long they've been out of the water. As soon as you put them in the water, immediately they take up their natural position. Yes. Okay, question, Mataji's question is on this point of, you know, the working of the brain. Because we've been presenting a very, you know, simple and kind of like clinical presentation. Is that, you know, basically you're saying the men are more fixed, the women will be more, have the emotional aspect. But then she points out that she's, you know, by experience seen that this is true, but at the same time as many men may be highly emotional and many women may be quite fixed and very steady. So different aspects of that. Point is what we mentioned is emotions come from attachment. Like if there's any material attachment, emotional or sensual, then there may be some very strong reactions, especially if the emotions or the senses are being obstructed. And so then immediately when you obstruct some kind of material experience, then there's anger. Krishna says then from lust, anger, when it can't be fulfilled, anger arises. So then you can see men maybe get very angry in this way because something that's there may be there. But generally what we'll see is that if the man is like that, he'll see his emotions and his anger in that will many times in cases be greater than the women's. Like women may not like somebody, but it's not enough to start a war. You know, they may go on, you know, little feuds like that. But the men, they don't mind starting one because point is they will have a tendency, they can go very far analytically, but if that same distance switches over into emotional, it's very far, right? Someone who's generally a balanced nature, the emotional and the analytical would be balanced. If someone is just always dry, no emotion, you'll say something's wrong, or always emotional and no kind of like analytical or no thinking power, you'll say that that's balanced. So there's balance. So the man, how like determined in that, they can go the other way and it's very far. So the same way as you'll see in the women, you'll see some are, you know, very much one way, has both. Because both are always working. The one, maybe more one percentage, more the other percentage. So you might find a woman who's, it's not very broad. So they don't think much, but the emotions aren't overly strong. It means if they're balanced, you know. At the same time, someone may be able to analyze very nicely, so they may be working. So wherever they are more or less, you may find that. Does that make some sense? So someone, you find women may be able to spend more time there. The emotions are still there. If you check, then in the application of what they're able to analyze, there'll be the personal aspect to it. Like that. That'll be there. So that's the whole idea is the women are supposed to try to keep the men on the other side. Because otherwise then things can get sometimes a little weird. You know? This is another topic. Yeah, that's what I said. When they get emotional, they don't think. So they don't mind going out getting themselves killed. You know, the women aren't going to do that. You know, it's like, go out, get yourself killed, then, you know, who's going to take care of the house and all that? You can try. But, you know, point is ultimately men are men, women are women. You can do the best you can. That's why the culture is there, so the interface is there. They have an interface, but they give each other the space. You know? They give each other more space. That's one thing I noticed between, like, let's say, the Anglo-Saxon cultures in the West and the European, is that they give more space. It means they tolerate more the others, you know, interests, hobbies, time spent with friends, this and that. There doesn't have to be as much physical closeness to be called a good family as in the Anglo-Saxon cultures. Then you come into the Asian and even more space is there. Like you see, like you go to a big program, you'll immediately see when the families come, the women go off with the other women, the men go off with the other men, and you know, there's a whole thing and food and talk and this and that, whatever goes on, and then afterwards they all come back together, and when they're going home together, then, you know, the husband and wife are talking, oh, it was a very nice program, this, that, though they never did anything together. But they feel that, yes, we did something together, we went to this program, though they didn't spend any time together at it. So it's just that there's that willingness to give that space to the other, that it's not so selfish that unless they're with me, that's quality time, you know? Means that there's quality time is emotional, not necessarily physical. That last question, and we'll come this side. Yes.
Not according to your own nature, just sometimes for benefit or just. And then they have to struggle a lot and just to be recognized and many things. And later on they find that actually this is not way how they act in life. And, many of women, they upset after many years, even many years of samkirtan or something like that. They find that actually they was very competitive with mind, not so much develop real qualities, then just lose the time for, you know, guess all this competition and Western type of thinking, it's still there. What do you think about this?
Question is that on the many times, especially with the first generation, then we're talking about even when the ladies join the temple, then, you know, they go on Samkirtan, they do so many different things, they have to move, you know, very much in the men's world, compete with the men. And then after some years, they find some difficulty with this. And the managers don't seem to necessarily, consider the nature of the girls and that, but just try to, you know, get some benefit by Samkirtan or some collection or some other aspect. So it's, you have a few aspects. One is it would kind of come up in the beginning, because Samkirtan, everybody can take part in some way or another. So like in the early days when they were, you know, mainly doing Harinam, then the girls were also very much involved. So it's like the whole temple would go out. I can remember, I wasn't there, but some other devotees who were would tell me. They would get out of the van and get to the spot where they're going to do, because they used to a lot of times stand in one place and do kirtan for, you know, 6 hours, 12 hours a day, like that. And then when they get to the place, then Brahmananda would say, all right, gopis in the front. And then the ladies would make the front row and that, and then the men would be behind, and they would be doing, playing the instruments and that, because the ladies would, you know, dance very nicely and all that. So it was, they were all very much part of the scene in the beginning. And also with the, even with the book distribution, then that also, you know, very nicely can work, because the Western nature is it has to be very active. You know, very few are, one is they were very young, most were not married, and they didn't have the training to, that they would feel uncomfortable in these situations. They'd rather be in another situation. So Prabhupada's basic program was, is whatever's the mentality of someone, deal with them in that way at that time. And as it changes, then you change how you deal. Just like how you deal with a small baby, then when they get a little bit bigger and they start talking, you deal differently. You know, and then when they're a little bit older than that, it changes again. When they hit teenage years, it changes again. When they're adults, it changes. So you can't say, well, just how it was before, that's how I'm going to deal now. Because living entities are fluid. They're always developing and changing. So in the beginning, these things may be okay. But if it's then seen that the girls are uncomfortable with that, then one has to be able to adjust with that and change that. Another aspect is there is the competition in the Samkirtan that came up has a good and a bad point to it. Good point is that as long as it's on the transcendental platform, then it's like somebody, oh, they distributed 100 books, we'll show them, we'll distribute 150. Like this, it's some fun for Krishna, you know, to do something more, and it's a light mood and all that. But if it actually becomes serious competition, where you want to beat the other guy and, you know, hope they don't do so well, then it falls from its transcendental position. So if that comes up, then it becomes actual competition. And that will be not only dissatisfying to the women, but also to the men. And then in that, then it's like, you know, it's whoever's name is read out as first, that's the best, everybody else wasn't as good, you know. And these kind of aspects come up, which cater very much to the Vaishya mood. Right? Vaishyas work because they get benefit. Right? Some result must be there. Brahma and Kshatriya, they work because they're supposed to. That's the duty. Like that. But Vaishya Shudra will work because of fame or facility. Something that they get from it. So, unfortunately, some places the emphasis got on that too much, brought out that kind of character. And then it becomes very, very rough. Because then in that case, when it comes down to competition, then one generally doesn't consider others. So that makes the mood more hard. Then the girls in that environment have to be hard to be able to deal with it and all that. Because otherwise, one can very nicely also do Samkirtan as a girl. One doesn't have to be a tough hussy to do. Because generally, it's the nature, and anybody, if one deals gently, and it's a woman, everybody will deal nicely. Like we see the example is at the churning of the milk ocean. When it came down to it, the demigods and the demons are about ready to kill each other. So the only way you could work it out is that they brought in some gentle lady, and she said that, well, I'll distribute it. So by nature, then the materialist always trusts women. Like that. That's the nature. If they have gentle qualities. Because it's just understood they're gentle, they're kind, all these nice qualities. So they'll do. So if one goes out and does book distribution dressed in a very nice, gentle way, speaks, deals, has that mood, you can always get someone to come take the book. You can speak softly and get them to accept. So one can easily maintain the feminine qualities. Though unfortunately most of the girls like to put on their jeans and other things like that and their makeup and go out there and, you know, stuff the book down the guy's throat and, you know, and do, you know, whatever methods that they want to use. But one can get that attention from other. But the thing is, the problem is that's many times not experienced in the West. The girls have not seen it or experienced how to be gentle and move and deal in the world. So it may be theoretical for a lot, you know. But it is possible. There are even to this day, even in the Western culture, women who have a more gentle nature and deal. And they get around. They get things done. Oh, I see. Okay. Does one maintain one's like Western competitive nature, or should the women try to develop the Eastern? Both the men and the women should develop, because one can have that drive. Means the thing is the advantage of the Western is they have the drive to get something done. So it doesn't mean that one can't do that in a gentle way. Like we see Prabhupada had the drive. He never did something in a Western way. His dealings with the devotees, his lecturing, his talking to the gentlemen, his talking to officials, he always did it as a nice, you know, high-class Indian gentleman. Like that. And one of the comments someone was telling me that they'd kind of like done some research or talking, maybe with Satsarup Maharaj or those people who work with Satsarup Maharaj when they were doing the interviews, because they went around to talk, to try to talk to everybody they could get their hands on who had talked to Prabhupada. And one of the main comments that everybody meant was is they had never met as nice a gentleman as Srila Prabhupada. Even if they didn't understand him as a devotee, that the minimum they just saw is this was a gentleman. So it is possible to move in the world and get things done using the Eastern culture. Because the Eastern culture contains everything, but in its balance. Everything. It means whatever is going on all over the planet is going on in India, but it has its place. Just like in the West, they take drugs. In India, they've been taking drugs before, Europe even knew, while Europe was still, going out with their big, what do you call it, their wooden clubs and clubbing the ladies over their head and dragging them home to the caves. It means these things are going on here. But it is only for a class of man who is very uncultured and low, like that. That common people will do that. Very low class, common people. The aristocratic people know about it. They're not interested. But the West makes it into something special, unique. Like that. It's always been going on here. Like that. Just, they know. Aristocratic people don't get involved. So it's a matter of we can develop it, but we have to try, we must have that determination to come to the platform where we can realize how to use that. So as long as we don't mind using the Western competitive spirit, then we'll probably find it more comfortable to work within that. But when we find that becomes difficult, then we should learn to switch. But ideally, we can try to engage that, learn the Indian culture, but still be able to function within the environment that we're in, at least while we're able to do that. Then once the girl may get married, have children, she may have to change that. She may not be able to do as much like that. But that's the whole point, is now you're training the children. When they grow up, then one can go out again. When the child goes to the Gurukul, or when they grow up and part of the temple, or they get married, then can go back to these things. But that time is spent in the middle for the children. So that character is good. The point is that if one can't see how to engage the Vedic culture in the Western environment, and one has a preference for the Western culture, one can follow it. But ultimately, one will become dissatisfied. So at that point, one should be willing to change. Does that make any sense? Yeah? Okay. Yes.
In Varnashram, we have seen that the grahasthas, they have to look after the brahmacharis and the vanprastha and sannyas. It is also that the business class looks after the shudras and the kshatriyas and the brahmins. So now I come to an understanding that the society, there are 25% brahmacharis, 25% grahastha, 25% vanaprastha, and 25% sannyasi is the ideal Vedic destiny. So
no, it's 25% of your own life. That's not the overall population.
I wanted to ask one question. Like, if you want to make an ideal one ashram society in our temple or something, so how can we do it? Like, we'll have this thing that this much percentage of devotees should be brahmachari, this much should be grahastha, and this much vanaprastha and sannyas. Can this make an ideal temple society? This way. This is my question. And in case we find that the we have got 25% everything, and there are more brahmacharis coming, then we say, okay, no, we cannot take in more because the balance will get disturbed.
Question is that has an understanding that the brahmachari, grihastha, vanaprastha, sannyas, everything should be 25%, 25%, like that. So is that the actual standard? So that, therefore, if you have already 25% and then a lot of brahmacharis come to the temple, then you say, no, I'm sorry, you can't come, it'll throw off the balance. Basically, is varnashram means everybody is situated according to their nature. So someone has the nature, you know, or is in the position to be trained as a brahmachari, they're trained. Doesn't matter how many or less there are. Because with time, that will change. Brahmacharis become grihastas. Grihastas become vanaprastas, like that. It's natural. So varnashram means that you establish according to actual the nature of what you have. Like that. That is the essential point. It's not a matter of a percentage. Because generally you'll find the bulk of the population is going to be grihasta. Like that. That's always going to be the bulk.
So in a temple, can we make this thing that we should have, to have an ideal situation? We should not have more gravastas or more brahmacharis. It should be equal something.
Are you listening, or? I said everyone should be engaged according to nature. It's not a matter that the ideal balance. The ideal balance is everybody's engaged according to their nature. So if you have a new temple and you're preaching and all it is full of brahmacharis and brahmacharinis, then there's a good chance that you're not going to have any grihastas, vanaprastas, or sannyasis in the temple. But you give it a few years and somehow or another by some mystic potency, the brahmacharis and brahmacharinis become married, and then you're going to start finding you have grihastas. And that will go on to a particular point and as brahmacharis, brahmacharinis, and then when the first one gets married, suddenly it creates this this amazing chain reaction, and then the whole temple practically gets married. Right? So you don't have to worry about the balance. You have to worry is, what is the nature of those in the temple today? How must they be trained? Right? You understand? So it's not a matter of some ideal balance. It's a matter of everyone is trained according to their nature. Alright? Okay?
One more question I have. We find that in our society, the grihasthas, and sometimes due to some misunderstanding with the management, they say that I will not work with the society, but I will be in Krishna consciousness, but I will not be a part of the temple. And they attend the temple programs and everything. How should we deal with this devotee so that the things are good? Like we don't set a wrong example or something. Like they are devotees, but they don't want to be a part of the temple. This thing.
Mm, okay.
So how should we deal with them? So make sure that they don't create a bad example, that everybody starts leaving the society and but be a part of Krishna consciousness.
Question is that someone, a grihastha, leaves the temple because of difficulty with the management, and then they don't want to work with the management, but they want to be devotees. So how to avoid this situation, how to avoid them from being a bad influence on others, like that. Main thing is management should be very expert, that they know how to give shelter and protect devotees. Then, if that is there, then much of this can be avoided, right? To be able to actually work with the individuals involved in their, you know, yatra. That helps a lot. Then, if you do have somebody who it's very difficult to work with, they have their own idea, because it mentions in the that if there's a mix of devotional service, it's not pure. You mix it with passion, ignorance, then there can be one's own idea. One can be a separatist, and then it becomes very difficult to work with such a person. So then they may find it more comfortable for everybody that they live separately. So basically one wants to encourage them in their Krishna consciousness, and they feel that, you know, it's all part of they're part of the establishment, but at the same time is one has to also train the devotees to understand what are the various positions in life. And it should be also understood that living outside the temple, maintaining oneself, is not a bad thing. Right? It's not bad if someone is a grihastha, lives outside, has their own business or some way that they're maintaining. That's not bad. That's one of the aspects of being grihastha. Right? So if that is there, then the temple can support such devotees, and there's not a problem. Where are you going? I was just about to ask you, what were your questions?
I have to go for social development.
Oh, you're on today then?
Yeah.
You're speaking? Or?
No, I'm just saying, going to see it. It's the last day and I haven't been there in the
whole day. Oh, I see. Yeah. Lokanath Maharaj is speaking or the Mataji is speaking?
Lokanath Maharaj.
Oh, okay. So it means his health's better. Okay. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Today they made the announcement
that he would give lectures. Yes.
After all the regulations, principles, and rules about Vanashram Dhamma, when you get back to the Gita, we find out that Krishna says, give up all these basic principles and just surrender. Does it mean that at the end or ultimately, Vanashram Dhamma isn't really necessary to surrender? Or perform devotional service.
Yeah. You all could hear the question? Uh-huh. So, Krishna, sarva dharmam parityaja, mame kam sharanam raja. So, the giving up of religion means, religion we have to understand is ritual. So, if we see the ritual as what is important, that is Krishna's asking us to give up. That attachment to the ritual or the form of the culture. Because the real purpose of the culture is to surrender to Krishna, to become Krishna's devotee. That is, so the surrender to Krishna goes beyond all these things. It doesn't mean that as we move through the world we're not going to follow him, but our attachment for those things is given up. Right? So if it comes down to being able to serve Krishna or, you know, aspects of Varnashram, the service of Krishna is more important. So if society is organized nicely, then within that we can serve Krishna nicely. And we don't, you know, there's no difficulties. But ultimately, we have to not be attached to anything. Our position, the particular results of the service that we're doing, you know, how our dependents will go on and this and that. And, you know, we had this plan for the temple and we just, you know, had this much more to go. No, when the end of life is there, you have to leave out all. So you can't be attached to any aspect of the especially the cultural form, you know? Attached to especially our position as in the Varnashram, like that. We can be attached to service, but ultimately we're attached to the service because it's connected to Krishna. It's not the service on its own. It's a service because it's connected to Krishna. You know, I think Prabhupada gives this story of one man who was used to bring water to the deity of Jagannath. That was his service. But he was so absorbed in that service, he never went to see the deity. So at the end of life, he just thought about, you know, water, you know, collecting water. So that's not the point. Is that collecting the water is important for us because it's connected to Krishna. It's Krishna's water. Like that. So ultimately, the service and all the aspects of Varnashram remind us of Krishna. Understand the impetus to remember Krishna. Right? We're doing book distribution. It's not just we're supposed to be selling some books. These are Krishna's books. So this reminds us of Krishna. It reminds us that these people we're giving them to, these are Krishna's devotees. Right? And we think how they'll be benefited by hearing all this. You understand? So the whole idea is that everything has to be connected to Krishna. Man mana bhava mad bhakto mad yajimam namaskuru. That we must follow these forms. We surrender to Krishna. You know, we perform devotional activities. We perform the sadhana. these different aspects are connected to Krishna. So the form of how we deal, how we behave, everything, then is we have to connect it to Krishna. So that is the importance. Right? Yeah.
You mentioned in one class that in ISKCON, when we find out our vana, that sometimes one quality becomes predominant, and sometimes it has to go to different vanas. Could you explain this?
Explained before that sometimes we see that when you're dealing with somebody is that today they be maybe manifesting one nature, and with time as they purify themselves another nature comes up. Means if the nature predominantly has ignorance in it, there's every chance that one's going to manifest the nature of, you know, preferring activities connected with the Shudra occupation, right? Then as we become purified, maybe more passion starts to come up. Less ignorance, the passion starts to come up. Then when you mix passion and ignorance, you get the Vaishya nature. More as that is purified, the ignorance goes away, the passion is there, little goodness comes, then Kshatriya. Passion goes, Brahman. You know? So that's there. It's just the same ways. There's more passion in the Grihastha, then less in the Vanaprast, less in the Sannyas. So these aspects are there. So the effect of the modes on us in our conditioned state can adjust. So at some point we will come to the position that we find comfortable and natural. Right? Then there's the other aspect of purifying that nature but doing it for Krishna. Right? We may have the Vaishya nature. We run our own business, have our own profits, everything. But after a while, then we want to give to the temple. Then we start to run businesses for Krishna. Then we just, you know, don't deal with that. We just deal with something that there's something. Maybe we just get into full-time books distribution like that. Just where we're comfortable in an environment where there's some trading going on, right? Even though now we're on the platform of I'm giving transcendental knowledge and they're happy with it and they're giving a donation for Krishna's service. It's not business anymore, right? Which is the proper platform of the preaching. So one's acting on that platform, but it's a natural just step. So ultimately, all the natures, all the varnas and ashrams, in their complete purified form, have their place in the transcendental position, in the position of Vaishnav. That's why you see Prabhupada can do anything, right? Prabhupada can do any activity. Someone just told me, yeah, okay. Yeah.
What else? Yes. Just in the class you talked about the differences between the brains of a man and a woman.
Yeah.
He's able to combine the rational and
emotional. The question is where is this information of how the brain works? This is in the modern studies. See, America, you know, bless their souls, really wanted to figure out why marriages don't work. So that they did a lot of research, and then some of these psychologists and all this, and they would do with these CAT scans and stuff on brains while men and women would do the same activities and all this. And after a while, they found out that it was all different. And then, you know, so many reports, this and that, and then you come up with so much literature on this. It's very, at least in the Western psychological field, this is very, very common. I don't know what the name is of it, but it's also taught in the universities. Even just within the man or the woman, which side of the brain is functioning for which activity. So therefore, you have to have a well-balanced group of activities so that all the parts of your brain are being used. Right? But even they say that only, I think it's 10% of the brain is used. They can't figure out what the other 90% is for. So Prabhupada mentions the, you know, by practicing Krishna consciousness, taking milk, living in a, you know, pleasant... how you say, sattvic and aesthetic environment, it develops the finer brain tissues. So the balance of the brain, 10% you need to function in the material world, and the other 90% is for understanding Krishna consciousness. Right? So the devotees use their brain the best. Right? So these are just common psychological things. See, in the Vedic culture, you don't really have to worry on this. You just talk about duty, because sadhana bhakti means we are devotees of Krishna. It is our duty to serve Krishna, because He's God, He's the source of everything, we're small in His part and parcel. Then it comes down to, okay, what are the duties? Okay, so for brahmacharis it's this, for the women it's that, for the grihastas, for the vanapras, these things. For someone practicing these aspects of sadhana, these are the duties like this. So generally for the purified intelligence, the purified heart, that works very nicely. Because you can tune into the mood like that. The more one is purified, the mood becomes a platform you can function on. Because you understand, means there's a platform of the senses, which makes one very dull. There's a platform of the emotions that makes a little more refined. So that's basically where the Varnashram is functioning. So in that, you know certain things go together. Just like if I say sweet rice and we'll put some salt in it. Then you'll go, no, it's not so good. Right? But salty and sweet goes together. A chutney, it means it's salty, it's hot, and it's sweet. Right? So theoretically, you could cut a few green chilies, throw it into the sweet rice, and put in a good amount of salt. Should be okay. But for that particular preparation, it doesn't work. You have to use other preparations, then you can combine like that. You understand? So this is all rasa. So in the same way that if you want to have a mentality that deals in a particular way, it has a complete field, right? Krishna speaks in the Gita about the field of activities. So from that aspect, then we can say that this matches nicely. And it works, because you understand that field, those things work nicely, right? So, in the Vedic culture, generally, that can all be understood working on those subtleties. But ourselves, coming from a background where, unless you can see it, smell it, touch it, or taste it, or look at it under an ion microscope or, you know, in a telescope, then you don't believe it. Right? So, since this background is there, the Vedic literatures are explaining, Prabhupada's explaining, devotees are not accepting. And they'll say, why? The modern culture, this, that. So we're using the principle of you take out a thorn with another thorn. Is that we don't want to accept Vedic culture by the natural explanations of the Vedic culture, because we're attached to the experience of Western culture we grew up in, and scientific evidence and modernality and intelligence and that. So therefore, we just take from that even the karmis are figuring out exactly the same thing. So we're using Prabhupada's principle is, you talk to the Indians, tell them about the philosophy of Krishna consciousness, they don't accept. You go to the West, make the Westerners Krishna conscious, because the Indians are interested in the West, bring those Westerners here, and they tell the Indians that it's useless. Now they'll believe it. If an Indian tells the Indian it's useless, they don't believe it. A Westerner tells the Indian, they believe it. Right? Like that. So it's just where the... So if we have this conditioning for modern science, this, that, so then we're just taking that and showing how it also proves the Vedic version. But ultimately, once one comes to the platform where one can work on that cultural level, then these are not important. Then you can talk about the nature of brahmacharya controlling the senses and the nature of chastity, and you can expand from there like that. You don't have to give... This is an example. This is a contemporary example given for a contemporary time. Does that make sense? Yes.
You were mentioning in the are you talking today about husbands and wives deciding whether they have children or don't have children. So just trying to understand, if there's a marriage, is there always a need to have children? Or there's no need? Or what's the Vedic understanding of that?
Yeah.
Is it because of perversion that people don't have it, or because they're actually detached? And if they're detached, do they need to get married? Just trying to understand that.
Oh, I see. Question is on marriage, on having children, is it important or not? The Vedic consideration is, you know, what is the use of a home without the children? Same time is, we are dealing with those who have grown up in that atmosphere, and so that's very natural for them. You know, it's part of the package. You know, it's like you have a meal, there's also sweets. You can also just eat rice dal and, you know, chapatis and no sweets. No chutney, no achar, no salt on the plate, no, like that. You can do that. But you add all that and then it makes it more complete. So it's a natural thing. That's a natural position. So the question that you're putting up, basically you'll see only is a question that the first generation will ask. Generally, you'll find second on won't ask that. Because it's either they don't want to get married, or if they want to get married, they take the whole, the package deal, like that. So for the first generation, then what happens is many times the experiences before becoming a devotee are, you know, so wild that one is not overly interested in getting too involved in the material sphere. But at the same time, because of lack of training, we're not able to then, the natural step of that, or the ideal situation of that, would be in one of the detached orders of life. Understand? As a brahmachari or, you know, like that. But because we're not trained, we have these material attachments. So then we find ourselves more comfortably situated as a grihastha, but at the same time as we don't want to get too involved because we've had such bad experience in the past. You know, some way, or a lack of training, or, you know. I've seen sometimes girls that just their situation in their home was so wild and bad, they're not interested in, even though they're married, they don't want children. Because they can't relate to it, because they couldn't relate to their parents, so now when they're as parents, they won't be able to relate to children, so they just don't want to get involved. But at the same time, then that carries a consequence with it, which is very essential, is then if one makes that decision, a couple make the decision that they're not going to have any children, then that also means no sex. No, just bus. Otherwise, it's cheating. Like that. So one has to understand that what is involved. No children means, you know, they'll sleep in separate beds, they'll do everything like that, and they don't get involved like that. You know, they just are able to somehow or another, you know, how you say? Mutually support each other in, you know, in the relationship and the emotions and in duties and taking care of the whole, whatever is the household arrangement, like that. But they have to live then like vanaprasthas. And vanaprasthas means no sex, right? And that means no sex from the Vedic standpoint, not from the Western standpoint. Right?
Just now it's saying how it's because of the emotional disturbances caused when a girl is young, she doesn't want to be interested in having children. So by not having children, will that situation get purified just by taking that approach, or would it be necessary? I've just understood, by not having child, what effect does that have on that level as well? Do you understand what I'm saying?
Oh, good. You all hear? Question is now if that's decided and that girl doesn't have children, how is that going to affect?
Yeah, the advancement, the development.
Development. Yeah. Means?
Because not giving and all this, not learning to be selfless.
Yeah, it means the point is these are principles that are learned by being a mother, then that having to give for others, having to take oneself away from the sensual platform, means one's own senses, care for others, and that, you know, until ultimately one comes to the platform of the mother of the universe, where it doesn't matter what it is, then you drag it home and feed it, you know, so... These principles of that caring, that softness and all that, these are natural positions. So if one is going to feel uncomfortable with the children, one still has to remember that these are aspects that are there. You know? So that means one at least has to take the philosophical, start to try to relate with other devotees, this and that. You know, otherwise it's going to be... But ultimately, by chanting Hare Krishna, by serving, the heart becomes purified. Because we're not trying to perfect Varnashram, we're trying to perfect our life. And in a normal situation, we can apply, you know, the textbook forms of it to our life, and they work. But if experience is very difficult, that may not apply. You know, either due to experience or karma or something, it doesn't work out. You know, we have something to learn. So basically, then the more that we're running within that restricted form, the more we have to put our reliance on the sadhana, on the philosophy, because vanaprastha means, if there's no children, there's no sex, means that's the stage of vanaprastha, means we're detached, we're over with that aspect, because vanaprastha comes to that stage. So then we have to kind of take up that mood. Then there shouldn't be great endeavor for material acquisition, no endeavor for positions, you know, politics, all these different kinds of things that are how you say, you know, natural of the mode of passion. We have to be able to function more on the platform of goodness and be satisfied with these kind of things, with the sadhana, and all that, and then the whatever is the simple home environment one establishes. So that's very important, you know. Something that Mataji had mentioned before, I think we somehow or another missed. She was asking about, does that have any effect on also the varnas or ashrams or like that? Mentioned about the men and the women. Means if there's passion more, then generally one will find the grihastha ashram is more suitable, right? If the passion is more there, one will find the occupational duties of management, business, more suitable. So if there's a lot of passion, a lot of emotion, like she said, some men are also very, 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 so much emotion, this and that. Now, if that emotion is in connection with position, influence, power, that will be more... the kshatriya nature, as long as it's other things balance. If it is more the emotions and the passion for facilities, it'll be more the vaishya nature. If it's more position, fame, you know, or the passions have heavy amount of lamentation, means whatever is said practically is always lamenting, then that will be, one will prefer generally working within the arts. Like that. Does that make any sense? That was your question. Yeah. I mean, we're now answering the last part of your question from before, because I forgot about it. If the goodness is there more, one can work more in the brahminical areas, the vanaprastha, the sannyas, the brahmachari. Like that. So like that, one can understand what kind of emotions are manifesting, what are they dealing with, like that. And that can also then one can see and see what are the best situations for the, what kind of analyzing you do. You sit around analyzing philosophy, you sit around analyzing how to organize a place, or sit around how to make money, You know, like somebody will get this and go, hey, wow, this is a nice picture, and go look at it and go, hmm, it says, you know, and then figure out that there's a market for this. And then you know the devotee who does something like this, and then immediately you just put it all together, and in 5 minutes you have a whole business lined up. You saw the picture. Right? So that's indicative of a particular kind of nature. You know? So like that, one can see what are the interests, how one deals, how one looks at, and then start to understand what is the best situation for oneself. But definitely if there's a predominance of passion, you know, desire, hankering, like that, then the grihastha, the kshatriya, the vaishya aspects are there. Though we do see there are many times materialistic Brahmins, like Dronacharya was materialistic. He was a Brahmin, but his area of study had more passion to it. It was the kshatriya arts and like that. And he wanted a result. He wanted revenge. Now, if he didn't want revenge, that's only his area. That doesn't matter. Because still, he's just a teacher. But we could see that his nature, so much passion was there that he was willing to go onto the battlefield. So then he was accepted as a kshatriya. That's why Arjuna could kill him. Otherwise, if he didn't come onto the battlefield, no question, he could never even, you know, speak against him, raise his voice, because he's his teacher. So you have to see where the modes are. Mode of goodness is very predominant, then brahminical, sannyas, vanaprast, brahmachari, like that. Ignorance is predominant, then the grihastha and arts. Right? Understand? So these things, it's just very natural. You see what are the values this Gita tells. You do something because of duty, or you do something because of what you're going to get. Like the Shastra says, do this for Krishna. Or if you don't do this, then you go to hell. So why are you doing it? You understand? Like that. So you can kind of, the Gita gives so many ideas. One can just think about what things he likes to do. And then do them for Krishna. If they're done for Krishna, they're perfect. They're not done for Krishna, it doesn't matter how perfect we do them. We do them for Krishna, they're perfect. So it doesn't matter what we do for Krishna. You know? Just like, you know, everyone would respect our ISKCON artists. You could say, well, that's Shudra work. But so much of our nice preaching goes on because of our artwork. Right? Right? We distribute so many of Prabhupada's tapes and all these different things and all that, and the Bhaktivedanta archives and all that, but to take those tapes, develop those tapes, put them through all the fancy machineries, you know, package them, do all that, that's all Shudra work. So then one may say, well, you know, but it's very important. Right? So anything that's an art is a Shudra activity. And now it's just a matter if you're doing it for Krishna, it's perfect. And who cares? If it's not being done for Krishna, then one can start to consider that, you know, one is a Shudra. But otherwise, one is a devotee, and this is one's service. So it doesn't matter. So, like that, then one has to take that package. So, grihastha means this is the form. There can be more acquisition, more this, more that. It means expand. Stri means to expand. So, it's natural one expands on all fronts. So if it is seen that the couple don't want, then the aspect of stri we are not applying. So stri has to be applied in the spiritual context. It means attaching ourselves to Krishna and expanding on that. So that means we have to absorb ourselves more in the sadhana, right? And that, and live more simply. Get more involved in the preaching, more involved in these kinds of things like that. Like that. So that means that one just moves to that step. You know, one may stay together for the next, you know, umpteen years. That's not a problem. Because vanaprastha also means husband and wife can stay together. Like that. And it, you know, what I'm saying. So it's like kind of in the middle. Does that make sense?
Yeah. one more question. It's slightly not related. You're mentioning about a child as it develops. It starts off by respecting the mother, and then it moves towards respecting the father. Why does that happen?
Question is, why does it happen that you start off respecting the mother and then slowly you see the father? Yeah, basically, well, Prabhupada explains in one thing, it's moving from the platform anamoy to pranamoy. So in the beginning, we see anamoy. The mother takes care of that. She feeds us, right? When a small baby, basically all it sees is the mother, because it's practically face-to-face with the mother. So she's feeding, clothing, taking care of everything. So in those very early age, but when one gets a little bit older, then one starts to see that there's basically other living entities than just you and your mother. You know, there may be other brothers and sisters, the father, this and that. Then the aspect of pranamoy starts to come up into the living entity, into the consciousness. The concept of pranamoy starts to become understood, is that there's other living beings and they are alive. But we still see it through sense gratification. Anamoy means our own sense gratification. Pranamoy means someone else's. Right? Like that. So, yeah. So then at that point, one will start to see that there's others in the family and that the father is there. So that naturally comes as a consequence of pranamoy. Right? And, yeah. So the mother... Mother means being that aspects, the duties of that are situated in, basically, in the pranamoy aspect. Because you're taking care of the senses of the child. So it's extended sense gratification. Right? But along with that, then because it's the aspect of mother in the Dharma, the religious principles, she has to teach them in the child in the higher principles of Dharma. So therefore the mother will then teach all these other aspects. You know, she'll be the one to point out, no, you don't do like that. You know, your father said, you know, that's it. You know, like that. You know?
Okay, and then in the stage where he moves towards the father, what aspect is the father starting to teach the child?
Oh, that's, I see, yeah, it's another looking. Then what question is this, what aspect as he starts to notice the father means is basically the authority, you know, and then deepening these principles that the mother is teaching, like that. Is that basically the aspect of authority, and then from there that moves on to then, you know, authorities outside in the world and the spiritual authority, the spiritual master and that. But that's all starting from the mother and supported by the mother. Like that. Something else to say? So, in the Varnashram culture, the question is like we see Brahmins are very fine, refined and all that, so how do you tell the difference between someone who's a Shudra nature and of a Brahminical nature, even though they both are doing arts, practicing arts? This is a very important question, because this throws off devotees like anything. It's kind of like if you have any ability in music, then you must be a Shudra. The whole point is it's not only what you're doing, but why you're doing it. So you'll see you take music. The Brahmin is singing for the deities, or sing for preaching. But you can't pay them money and they'll sing for you. But a Shudra, you can pay money, they'll come and sing for you, no problem. And they'll sing to please you. Devotee will sing for the deities, for the kirtan. You like it, you don't like it, that's your problem. But the Shudra will adjust to please the audience because he wants you to pay again later. The other thing is the Shudra wants to become famous for their art. Like that. Shudras are nuts after fame. Like that. And you see Shudras, when they become famous, then when they start to lose some of their fame, then many times they get into drugs, alcohol, they completely space out, you know. They become so depressed because that was so important for them. Like that. While the Brahmin is famous now, goes, then he understands. This time others are coming up, let them become, I've done, I'm moving. Like that. So in other words, Brahmin means one who does things, all whatever it is. Means all the Vedic sciences and branches of knowledge and arts, a Brahmin may be expert in any or all of them. Like that. Even the Shudras would go to the Brahmins to learn the Shastric side of music. They want to know about music, drama, dance, architecture, you know, engineering. They would go to the Brahmins and learn the Shastric side of it. While the actual art itself, they may learn from another, you know, musician, another artist. That's not a problem. But the Shastric side of it, they would learn from the Brahmin. So this way, in other words, for the Shudra, it's his occupation. For a Kshatriyan Vaishya or a Brahmin, then it may be their hobby. But it also may be the Brahmin's area of expertise and knowledge and teaching. It may be that there's a Brahmin, he teaches music. But generally you'll see they'll only teach in the Gurukul to others of a like-minded nature. They generally are not teaching music to the musicians. May, but not necessarily. Does that make any sense? So that means you'll see, that's why we read in the Krishna book, that Krishna, he learned, first he learned, you know, he learned the Vedic literatures. Then he learned all the supportive literatures. Then he learned his duties according to Varnashram. Then he learned the 64 arts. So learning of the 64 arts, the Brahmins, the Kshatriyas, the Vaishyas, they all learned that. Like that. But it wasn't their occupation. Right? It was an area of hobby or knowledge. But for the Shudras, that's their occupation, that art. Because art is how you practically do something in the world. The Shastra comes down to a point. You know, the Shastra is the theory, the theology. But when you actually apply it, that's the art. That's in anything. You know, even how to do the artik. The theory is there. The philosophy is there. What has to be there? What is done? You know, seven circles. But now, how you hold the lamp, how you make the seven circles to make it look nice, that's the art. You know? Krishna wears a dhoti and a chadar and a turban. He wears a peacock feather. You know, he wears Vaijanti mala. That's the Shastra side of it. Now, how you put that on, that's the art. You know, understand? Morning time you cook these things, noon time this, evening time this. You know, this is the way it's these are the kinds of, you know, these things are mixed together with each other. But now how you actually cook those things, that's the art. So everything, every Shastric thing comes down to an art. So the idea was, is then the Brahmins knew from the top to the bottom. Kshatriyas also. Vaishyas to some degree that they could, and Shudras just knew the art. And if they had the ability, then they could learn the Shastric side of their art, if they had interest. Some want to know, some absolutely don't care. Like that. So that's there. So you can see just what is the interest, nature, other aspects, what are their motives. You have to watch their whole life. You know, like in kids, you know, there's not a facility to do business, but you watch how they deal, how, what is their moods, what is their determination, length of determination. And then you can decide, you can see what are the basically the varnas. Anything else? Or? Oh, no, absolutely not. Question is when we deal with the children, we understand the nature, do we tell them the nature? No. It's the last thing you tell anybody. Because it's not important. Because otherwise then it becomes a designation. Point is if someone has ability in some field, let them do it. Because you won't really know what their nature is until they get out of the gurukul. So we say that this is for brahminical training, it's for Brahmins. The facilities, the training that we do matches for Brahmins, for Kshatriyas, you know, very pure Vaishyas. It works for them. So those with that kind of nature will feel comfortable in the environment. Those who don't won't feel comfortable, though they may be very nice, you know, intelligent students. Like that. So then, like that, you get the training, because there's certain principles you have to get in. The acceptance of authority, you know, the proper standards of cleanliness, how to deal with others properly, learn the philosophy, learn how to give that to others. You know, so many things they have to learn. So it's an environment in which you can teach it. And because of nature, they'll feel comfortable in it, so you teach them that way. But now when they get out of the school, what they actually do, then that you have to see.
Try to direct them and give them tips what they should do?
That is there, they'll ask. But the point is that they've been doing something, and then they'll look for an environment generally that they like, whatever they like doing best, that's what they like to do. Like we had one boy, you know, something interested in cooking. Then that, and ran our kitchen. You know, one of the students, they run the kitchen. Then when they get out, and you know, they learn the yajnas, like this, their Indian background. So then when they get out of the school, then this one went, and now is in a temple in America. And then now they're the head of the kitchen there. And that, and they help in the congregational preaching to the Indians, and they help manage the temple. So it's very similar to what they were doing here. Right? But now they run the kitchen how they want to run it. Well, here they have to run it the way I want to run. You know? So that nature stayed, though they don't necessarily cook in that in the way we do here. The principle of cooking they took, but not the particular kind of cooking. You understand? So the one got across, not the other, like that. So one has to be very open on that, how it will apply. You train, then you have to see what will happen when you actually put it into practice. Right? There's another boy here, never did anything with collecting this and that. Was very good at chanting mantras and doing the puja, very peaceful, steady. Now he's in America, and he's very good at preaching to the Indians, and is a very big collector. Hardly does anything with puja and that. Like that. You know, so you have to see when they get out into the field what they'll do with it.
But you train them so that they have the facility to go in different directions.
Point is training means is that they have the basic principles of how to survive. Right? Just because you have a degree in a particular area doesn't mean that you're going to make it in the material world. If that was guaranteed, there would be no students with degrees who wouldn't have a job. But there's plenty who don't, because they have the academic degree, but they never teach them practically how to use it. right? University ever gives, you know, right, you know, practical day-to-day experience? Normal university? No. Maybe a community college, maybe a trade school, because they're training you actually for the world. The other ones are not. They're just training you up, giving you your degree, and saying, you know, go for it. Like that. So the Gurukul education means you train him in the principles in which you can function in the material world. If you have a good work ethic, right, you can work with others very nicely, you have proper respect for authority, you can take care and show, you know, have a helping mood towards those who are junior to you, then where you're not going to find a job? Right? You tell me, who's not going to give you a job? Right? But if you just come in with a piece of paper, if they need somebody with that piece of paper, then you get a job. Understand? The people who are actually on top of the material world don't necessarily have big academic degrees. Like that. Like that. You know, the guys with the big PhDs, Nobel laureates, they're not running the world. You know? Like that. You know? Mataji's question is that sometimes we see that it's that either the child wants or it's appreciated in the society if the child has some education in a particular area, say if they want to become a doctor or they want to be get into construction or something like that. So the Gurukul setup is meant to train one in the philosophy, the culture, and yeah, mainly in the philosophy and the culture. You know, the actual character. Like we hear of a devotee. Like when we see the 26 qualities of a devotee, we don't hear first quality is tilak, second quality is neck beads, third quality is Brahman thread, fourth quality is dhoti or sari, fifth quality is, you know, like that. No, first quality, you know, like that, humility, you know, poetry, all these things. So it's qualities. So the Gurukul is for training one in qualities and the philosophy. That's the main purpose of that. Then if you have a specialized Gurukul that's meant to train you in a specific area, means outside that, like the Gurukul specializes in teaching Ayurveda, or it specializes in teaching the Stapana Veda, so you learn, you know, engineering or these kind of things. Or if someone, then you would have to switch from the general Gurukul to the other Gurukul, or go to that Gurukul from the beginning. Just like the Pandavas, then when they were older, then they started training in Drona school. So that was outside the general just philosophical training, like that, that they would get in their younger years. So these kind of really practical things like that generally start when they're like 16, where it's very specialized and that's just what you do. Below that, then it's more general, philosophical. You know, the Sanskrit, the arts, all the things you have to memorize, learning all your English, your math, your all those things like that. And then from 16, then you can get very serious as an occupation in that training. The other thing is to see that the parents or the child, if that's what they want, then you have to go to that school. Like if you want to become a doctor, you have to go to a medical school. You want to go to become a lawyer, you go to a law school. But it's also understood that if you go to a medical school, one one cannot expect that when one comes out of medical school, if the child actually wants to become a lawyer, he'll be able to do it. Right? I don't think anyone could go to a medical school and when their child graduated after 5 years and then put a court case against the school that you didn't train my child to be a lawyer, which he really wants to be. Then the question will be, why did you put him in the medical school? It means if you want the child to go to Harvard School of Medicine, then there's no need to go to the Gurukul. One can go for the first basic few years to get some basic